Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody. I'm Marshall Poe, the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network. The NBN is run by volunteers, but it also has considerable expenses. In order to continue bringing you the in-depth author interviews that you count on, we have to pay our bills. So we'd like you to consider making a tax-deductible contribution to the network. It's easy to do. Just go to any NBN page and follow the donation link. Since we're part of Amherst College Library, you'll be taken to an Amherst College Library page. Go to the NBN line on that page and follow the instructions. That's it. From all of us at the network, thanks for your support.
Hello and welcome to the New Books and Digital Culture Podcast. I'm your host, Greg Evans. What would it be like to live in a world with no cash, no coin purses or wallets stuffed with dollar bills, no piggy banks, no wishing wells, no money under the pillow from the tooth fairy? How would we buy old LPs or use lawnmowers at flea markets or on Craigslist? What would you leave next to your cup of coffee at the diner? How could you tip a street performer? What would Scrooge McDuck swim in? Today's book is The End of Money: Counterfeiters, Preachers, Techies, Dreamers, and the Coming Cashless Society, written by David Wolman and published by Da Capo Press, in which he takes an in-depth look at the history and heritage of physical cash, what it means to us in the modern world, and what forms it could take in the future. Hi, David. Thanks for joining me.
It's my pleasure.
I wonder if you could tell us a bit about yourself.
Sure. I am an author and journalist. I live in Portland, Oregon. And I am a contributing editor at Wired Magazine. And when I'm not writing magazine articles, I write nonfiction books. And I seem to have accidentally fallen into a beat or pseudo beat that I guess could be best described as a guy who's interested in seemingly small and seemingly simple, straightforward topics that, in fact, when you put them under the microscope, are anything but simple. This was definitely the case with this most recent project. The book is called The End of Money, and it is about the past, present, and dubious future of cash.
Yeah, and a very good examination it is, too. It stood up to that microscopic examination, as you say. You enlisted quite an amazing and sometimes colorful cast of characters to help you illustrate the points and concepts you lay out. Why did you decide to write this book, and how did you arrive at the idea to structure it that way?
Well, it began, I think, in early 2009. I was reading a little bit in the newspaper about the costs of manufacturing pennies and nickels, as many people may know of late. We are, depending on the date, of course, because the spot price of metals is quite variable, but we're at roughly 2.5 cents per unit per penny right now, and it costs about 11 cents per unit per nickel right now. And the numbers were similarly lopsided back in 2009 when I was reading up on this and experiencing some mild outrage. Just because you don't have to be an economist to see that as a ridiculous proposition. The subject had sort of been covered. You know, there was an episode in The West Wing that was poking fun at the citizens to retire the penny, and the Wall Street Journal took a stab at this, Stephen Colbert. Somehow, though, I wanted to kind of get into the fray a little bit of this discussion about, at least about small change. My thinking on it had not yet kind of moved to the place of scrutinizing cache in its entirety.
Right.
Then I was kicking around some ideas with an editor at Wired, and that's when we came up with the kind of more blustery, pugnacious thesis for a short essay. Well, let's just kill cache already. Everything else in our lives is moving to the digital realm, but cache is so ridiculously analog. Let's move on already. And the response to the essay was enormous, not always necessarily friendly by any stretch, but enormous. Even just by the sheer volume of correspondences I received from people compared to, you know, a feature I would write that was four times as long and much more substantive, I would think. But I really obviously struck a nerve. And that was sort of indicator number one that this subject might have legs as far as a book was concerned. And then secondly, what happened is one angry reader who wrote in after a kind of a tirade about fiat currencies and the Federal Reserve, and specifically getting rid of the Federal Reserve, he said this thing to me with his note. He said, "Do you even know what money is?" Sort of stopped me in my tracks a little bit, because I felt like, well, yes, I do. You know, I know some of these basics that come packaged in economics jargon, like medium of exchange and standard unit of account and store of value. But he got me thinking about, you know, how much I did or frankly didn't know about the history of money and the history of coinage and then banknotes and their role in our lives, their impact on our psyche, their place in our sense of nationalism, all of it. And so that was sort of motivation number two for the book project, was to go out and answer this question of what is money, but through the specific lens of cash, or this question of cash's fate. And so I set off to try and do that.
You also talk about your one-year attempt to go without cash. Could you tell us a bit about what that was like?
Sure. And, you know, there are two different ways to come at this piece of the topic. Some of it has to do with really just finding an entryway into what could have been a more academic subject matter, right? But I'm not an economist or an academic. I want to write something that is informative, I hope, but also entertaining. And, you know, to do that, you have to reach into your tool bag, especially with a subject that, you know, money and cash, what could be more sexy than that? Well, if you start talking about sovereign currencies and central banking, all of a sudden we're not quite in the realm of hot, sexy topics anymore. So you have to be on guard, or I guess the other way to put it is you have to work hard to keep people interested in a topic they might think they're not at all interested in. And colorful characters is obviously top of the list as far as tactics for doing so. And then number two is kind of this conversational tone, which you use to describe personal experiences. And for me, I felt like the attempt to avoid cash, not even touch the stuff, would be a useful way to kind of sprinkle into the manuscript, some of the conversational aspects of this topic and dive into the personal a little bit more. You know, I didn't want it to be all about me at all, because that's not really my style, and because who wants to read for 10 pages about me struggling with a parking meter somewhere? It's just not, you know, this is not George Plimpton lining up against the Detroit Lions kind of participatory journalism excitement. But there were occasions, and we can touch on some if you'd like, when my cashless lifestyle did sort of get me into a pickle a little bit, and when I felt like it could sincerely add to the conversation or the points I was trying to make in that particular section, well, then I would kind of bring it in or roll it out. And when it really felt extraneous or kind of showy or silly, I got rid of it. And of course, you know, I'm hearing from people who say there's not enough of you and your cashless year in the book. And then I'm also hearing, thankfully, from people who say, no, that was just enough. Like, we don't need you in the parking meter.
Yeah. What I am curious about is, has that experiment had any permanent effects for you? Has it changed your routine permanently?
Not too much. I mean, You know, the fact of the matter is it would be infinitely harder to go all cash for a whole year, if not impossible practically, or the financial and time costs of that would be severe as far as going off to pay my car loan and my payments and all these things in cash. I mean, it would just be asinine. And there were many weeks that would go by where I didn't really even notice that I was conducting this experiment or living this alternative lifestyle deliberately, although not the alternative lifestyle you might be thinking right there. Anyway, it wasn't that hard. I'm trying to think of ways that it has had a permanent impact on my life. I certainly have more of an allergy to paper money than most people, I think. And of course, you know, you can go out and buy the book with cash. Definitely. That comes up a lot at book readings. And of course, if someone were to give me a briefcase full of cash and it was totally above board transaction, I would not refuse it. I still, you know, I'm a writer, not a gazillionaire. So I respect cash's purchasing power. Right. But when it comes to these pale green and beige-ish pieces of paper, I find them particularly filthy, and I really just don't want to touch the stuff. And so I think I was kind of mildly a germphobe at the start of the project. And then as I thought more about this and did more research, even into like the bacteria that are growing on banknotes, you know, now I'm sort of a full-fledged germaphobe, at least when it comes to paper money.
Yeah. Well, that's a compelling point there. It's not one I tend to notice myself, but I think it's valid.
Well, part of that has to do with how wired we are to love the stuff, right? And this was a really fun section to explore in the book and kind of unpack the psychology of money. Part of the reason you've never thought of that is, you know, what could be more innocuous, number one, than cash, but also, you know, it's empowering, and certainly Hollywood and MTV have it in countless images associated with power and wealth and success and, you know, romantic glory, the whole bit, right? And even just when you're 5 years old and lose a tooth for the first time, you know, from that day forward, you are really wired to covet these coins and notes, whether you want to admit it or not. And I don't mean covet like you're some greedy jerk, right? It's more talking about kind of the psychology of money and how it plays tricks on our minds. You know, we don't think of banknotes as dirty pieces of paper. You know, why would we? But, you know, there aren't many other kinds of piece of paper that, you know, could be covered in filth sitting in the gutter that you're going to reach down and pick up.
Well, it depends on how big it is, I guess. Kind of moving toward the time you spent talking about government's relationship to cash and how printing money helps some agencies and how cash makes other agencies' job more difficult. What do you think it would take for a government to examine these issues more closely, and how likely is it that you think that'll happen?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, here in the States, at least, we see the question of killing the penny sort of rise and fall every couple of years or so when someone in Congress is brave enough to propose it. And then it gets shot down pretty quickly through a combination of forces, I think, that have to do with nostalgia, number one, and then vested interests, whether it's sort of the vending machine industry or the zinc lobby. And it sounds silly. You know, I know we're not talking about, you know, the oil lobby per se, but or oil special interests. But nevertheless, you know, it is a little bit depressing that special interests can influence something as seemingly small as the fate of a pretty much worthless unit of coinage. So that's here in the States. What would it mean? How could we get government agencies to have a more earnest dialogue about the pros and cons of cash? I think if we look abroad, we can see examples of how this actually is happening. And one place where the conversation is most lively right now is in Sweden. They have a culture where they used to use a lot of cash, but now they've had a real backlash. And you have a union of bank employees lobbying the government quite hard to get rid of cash entirely because they're sick of robberies and the costs that they incur. And you also have a more outspoken head of the central bank, which I think matters. And, you know, he is referenced in the book because he says some things that central bankers are not supposed to say, either by content or clarity. Central bankers are supposed to be boring, number one, and vague, number two. And, you know, he said things to me that, and in public, that frankly, you know, you couldn't really get away with here, at least in the United States right now. For example, he was saying, you know, government needs to have a more honest accounting of the cost of cash. This is not word for word, obviously, but his point was that government needs to have a more honest accounting of the cost of cash. It's not just manufacturing, distributing, and babysitting the stuff, right? Government also has to pay law enforcement officials to go after bank robbers and pimps and drug dealers, all the people that are using cash to bolster their businesses. And right. Government has to pay not just to reimburse the bank for lost funds or damage to a vault or what have you, but you know, the hospital bill for the bank employee that was injured, or the PTSD counseling for those who were involved in a scary episode or what have you. You know, there are these concentric circles that extend outward from cash itself, whether or not it's involved in criminal enterprise, that, you know, this guy is saying we need to account for more carefully, because citizens are incorrectly thinking that having correct change available to them in every single cash register throughout the land is like a constitutional right for them, when it isn't. It's something, you know, it's a service. And I think that's something that will be important for this, for the future of money and cash and specifically. So if we are in the States ever going to move ahead with, you know, forget just killing cash entirely. If that's too radical for you, let's talk about killing the $100 bill. You know, that conversation has to be from Treasury on one side, which is obviously profiting, to talking with the FBI and Secret Service and DEA about how much the role of the $100 bill in the underground economy makes their job harder.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It was fascinating to, and that's another thing that had never really occurred to me when thinking about money, is all the pluses and minuses in terms of the profit involved, so to speak, versus the cost of it. There were one of many eye-opening things about the book. You mentioned the shadow economy that exists because of the anonymity of cash. How would no more cash prevent crime? Could non-trackable alternatives be found?
So the short answer is that getting rid of cash, of course, will not eliminate crime. And I don't think from your question that's what you were suggesting. But
no,
the position
no.
I have to take, or a disclaimer right. I feel compelled to make, because a lot of people sort of they have this reflex response that, well, if you get rid of cash, it's not like you're going to get rid of crime. Crooks will just move into the digital realm. And of course they will. You know, they're already there in spades. But the reality is that, let's talk about bank robberies in the United States, for example. 10,000 bank robberies here in 2009, 2010. There is no way you could honestly tell me that in the cashless future, all 10,000 of those idiot thugs would be tech savvy enough to adapt and become computer hackers. So, you know, that's kind of a silly example, but it also isn't. You know, the same thing is true for drug dealers or pimps or tax evasion. You know, all of prostitution and tax evasion, all of these things will persist in the digital future, yes. But, you know, you make the enterprise a little bit more difficult, and that's you know, you're creating a disincentive in the economic sense of it, and you're just making the bar a little bit higher so that less people are able to engage in the activity. You know, it's a little bit like, you know, gun laws or something like that. You know, of course, nobody's right. naive to think that we will end violent crime in America by making guns a little harder to come by, but why not raise the bar a little to make it more difficult so that some of the people we don't want to have guns can't get them? And, you know, so I think that's where this conversation is pointed. But, you know, what's interesting is that guns have been implicated as sort of problematic for for eons, right? But Cash has really, nobody has ever stepped up to indict Cash in any way, shape, or form. And that's what was kind of fun about this project, if not suicidal. I mean,
yeah, right.
You know, there's a sacred cow element to Cash for a number of reasons, some of which we touched on a moment ago. You know, we're wired to love this stuff from a very early age, but also there's this sense of Cash's relationship to liberty. And of course, the anonymity of transactions is very important to people. And this sense that, you know, using Cash is almost more noble or virtuous than using other payment mechanisms and, or other ways to store value. And, you know, that's a legitimate sometimes, but it's also a really naive point of view in other ways.
In talking about crime and how Cash relates to it, it kind of comes into the issue also of privacy and anonymity, which you get into in the book. Do you think there's a way that electronically based systems or a cashless system can retain any sort of level of my personal privacy, even if I'm not doing anything more than, you know, buying books on Amazon, yet at the same time be more resistant to crime and terrorism funding and money laundering and such?
I think that's the essential question, right? I don't think anything will ever provide the anonymity that Cash does. Although we're seeing a glimmer of hope with something called Bitcoin right now, which is this kind of cryptocurrency that a lot of techies are quite enthusiastic about. But other people will very quickly say that it is not at all secure in the anonymity sense of it. And, you know, this is one of Cash's great attributes. But the distinction that I tried to highlight in the book is really the difference between anonymity and privacy. And, you know, I'm hoping that there's room for technologists in the near future. And I think we're seeing signs of this, not just with Bitcoin, but other technologies out there that I'm hearing about, where technologists can come up with, you know, more robust ways to protect our privacy, certainly more so than the existing debit and credit card networks.
Right.
But, you know, I think I would also push back a little bit toward those who are most vocal and most most eager to defend the benefit of being anonymous with Cash, because I find that the people who really care most passionately about that are the ones who want a free ride and don't want to pay their taxes or are involved in sort of nefarious activities. And of course, you know, there are a gazillion people out there who just want to buy a box of chocolates for their sweetheart on Valentine's Day with Cash. And that is hardly illicit activity. So I get that. Those people, though, they want privacy. They don't want anonymity.
Right.
So, you know, in conversation, of course, what's the difference really? But, you know, I think brass tacks, there is actually a huge difference. And in a civil society, not only do you not want anonymity, you don't even deserve anonymity. You know, if you're going to vote, if you're going to have a driver's license, if you actually wanted to pay your taxes, already you are a known quantity in the Orwellian sense of it, right? So anonymity is already a non-starter. The question is, do you have adequate privacy? And we should be fighting for privacy and better privacy in the age of Facebook and Google and the rest of it. So I'm not at all blasé about identity theft issues and privacy issues, you know, whether it's government or corporations snooping on us. But in a civil society, there is a tension between your civil liberties and law enforcement's right to know stuff or hunt for information. That is just how it is. And it can be a real drag and it can be very disconcerting, you know, when watching a movie like Minority Report or when just traveling on an airline and going through airport security and seeing cameras everywhere and having all of your stuff examined. You know, that is an enormous invasion of privacy, but it is the kind of continuous tug of war between our right to privacy and law enforcement's right need to know things. And, you know, this, again, in the sort of continuing the vein of kind of a suicidal thinking or thesis. I don't know if this is necessarily the most popular line of thinking, but it's one I'm willing to defend because I think it happens to be accurate.
Well, I do see your point. For me personally, I tend to be kind of old school, just in the sense of I'm not keen about having everybody and their brother know what I'm doing, even if I'm not doing anything illicit or shameful or anything else, just in general. I personally have chosen not to do anything with something like Facebook for that very reason. But at the same time, I also recognize that attitudes toward privacy are changing in current generations, and that the tension that you describe is changing. I don't know whether one direction or the other, but it's not like it's not the same as it used to be.
Right. I think that's an astute observation, and you know, I see that a lot with like the tech savvy demographic that is so eager to say yes to mobile payment tools, especially because a lot of those same people know some of the potential security pitfalls, et cetera. But you know, they see a value proposition in using these tools. They're excited to use them. They live in the age of kind of sharing and where transparency is a greater virtue than privacy, perhaps, or I should say secrecy. You know, again, I don't think those people are necessarily blasé about privacy invasion either. But I think you're absolutely right that our notion of what is the right amount of privacy is actually a moving target through time and through history.
Yeah, and it's to a certain extent illusory, as you mentioned, because I do buy online. I do use a debit card. I do have a smartphone.
Oh, we know where you are.
Oh yes,
Greg, I can see you now with my hidden cameras.
Can you see what I'm doing now?
Hopefully, you're not making a rude gesture toward me or something.
No. And in that context, you've mentioned carrying around in your wallet various buy 10, get one free cards from local coffee shops. I've got a few myself, mostly from pizza and sandwich shops. And that's, on the one hand, that kind of incentive tracking is not anonymous or private either. And yet we all eagerly embrace it, or embracing the buyer's card at your supermarket so that you get the cheaper price and they get to track what you buy all the time, or what the person holding your card is buying, because it's not necessarily they don't know you, but they know your signature. So all these issues of privacy and whatnot are a lot more complex than kind of the knee-jerk reaction that some people have about, I want my privacy.
It is so true. And you know, zooming out a little, this is kind of the incredible paradox for me that has made this whole project so interesting, is that to such a great extent, we've actually pushed cash pretty far to the periphery of our everyday lives, at least people like you and me in wealthier countries. Right. And yet when you draw attention to that fact and urge people to walk over to the edge of the cliff and say, hey, wow, you know, cash is just a few hundred yards from the edge here. What is its fate? Do we want to push it over the cliff? Do we want to save it? You know, or let's get rid of it already. People go bananas in defense of cash as if it was the thing they're using all the time to store their wealth and as a medium of exchange, etc. When all of those people enjoy the benefits of money in electronic form, in various electronic forms, not just credit cards. You know, they enjoy these benefits even though they don't even stop to recognize it in that way, you know, or right. Enjoy the benefits, you know, just having a bank account, you know, there's no drawer with your name on it, Greg, at the bank that,
wait, what?
With a pile of paper or gold bars inside or anything like that. You know, it's just zeros and ones on computers. So sure. Money is electronic mostly already. And it's almost like people don't like to be reminded of that fact, you know, let alone sort of money's, the magic of money's value, or the currency's value. And, you know, when you draw attention to these things and ask people to kind of, tag along with you on a journey exploring some of these questions, they get very uncomfortable about the privacy thing, about the value of money, about banks. And, you know, that is, you know, that's interesting and makes for terrific conversation. But specifically when it comes to, defending cash, that is quite the paradox that so many people don't really use it that much, but then they go nuts when you say, well, maybe don't really need it anymore.
Right. Yeah. I think that it may be that for a lot of people, although they don't use it in concrete form, it's still enough of a concept, a solid concept in their head, that they use it for accounting even as they're moving away from using it physically.
I think you're right. I think you're right. But my guess, and I've seen some of these things already in action, is that digital tools are rapidly coming along to recreate that experience of kind of dealing with tactile objects, so you kind of get the same satisfaction and kind of blanket feeling of familiarity with the objects, or relinquishing the funds that comes from, you know, today handing over those real world pieces of paper. You know, there are going to be plenty of technologies to kind of recreate that experience. So I think once you are looking at this more in the, you know, the 8 to 18 year time horizon, as opposed to the 8 to 18 month time horizon, you know, all kinds of amazing things are coming down the pipe.
Right. Yeah. And one of the kind of harking back to the buy 10, get one free cards. One of the things that reading your book, one idea that made it, that popped into my head as a result is, wouldn't it be nice if, along with swiping your debit card or waving your phone to make a payment, that sort of incentive tracking could be included in the transaction electronically without us having to deal with all those little cards?
Oh, it's coming. Don't worry. If not, it's already here. I think there's an app called Perka that I've seen, P-E-R-K. And no, I'm not like a show for their company or anything like that. And no, none of the coffee shops that I frequent actually accept the thing. But it's the same exact idea you're talking about. Do away with that paperclip of those, you know, frequent customer cards. And when you have 10 visits, it's logged into your phone and your 11th cup of coffee is free. Or in fact, if you use this particular service, maybe you only have to purchase 9 cups of coffee before your 10th one is free. Whereas the rest of the Lilliputians using cash, you know, they have to buy 10 of them before the freebie, and they have to deal with the costs and risks of a cash existence anyway.
Right. And there's a little bit of a parallel between the two. I mean, whether I'm handing bills, Or whether I'm using a little cardboard card with stamps or cutouts, I'm still having to handle it and move it back and forth, and there may be other ways to do it. So at the same time that maybe there's a reluctance to give up cash, we're still kind of hooked on these little cards.
Sounds like you definitely are. No, and I am too. You know, nobody likes to. It's because they have value, you know, within them. It's not very much, frankly, but it's there. And you know, that's the thing. As soon as people see value proposition, and as much as that's kind of an MBA term that I loathe, it's the right one to call on in these circumstances. You know, people don't like these talking about the cashless future, or let's just say new forms of electronic money. And then all of a sudden you roll out one of these tools that's easy to use. And P.S., if you use this, you get to save 10 to 15% on all of your purchases at Starbucks or Target or American Airlines. You know, people dive in. And, you know, that is our legacy. You know, we wait for the value proposition. And while, that's sort of step two. Our legacy is that, you know, we are very skeptical of new technologies at first, probably as we should be. But, you know, look back at how much people thought that putting radios in automobiles was going to be the end of the world, and it would just be carnage on the highways. And gradually we warmed to the idea, and then suddenly someone actually saw some value proposition there because they could listen to some cool tunes or NPR. And, you know, then all of a sudden you live in a different world, and every car has not just a radio, but CD player, et cetera. And, you know, same thing is happening with future forms of money, and especially mobile money. You know, people are very distrusting of it right now, especially, I shouldn't say everyone, but, you know, the older generation is going to be traditionally much more distrusting of, or mistrusting of, these tools than younger, more tech savvy people. But, you know, as the value proposition becomes that much clearer, people will say yes. They do. That's our habit.
Yeah. I am of an older generation, and yet because I have been in IT all my life, I tend to be more on the cutting edge of a lot of things. But I do definitely see that slow, grudging acceptance of new technology, and it takes longer with people over a certain age.
And I don't think, you know, how could there possibly be anything wrong with that? And you know, for those who, no, not that you're saying so, but I think that's both natural and probably a good thing, right? Because they have, you know,
we've learned skepticism.
You've learned from skepticism, and also you've seen more, especially you've seen more kind of ups and downs with the economy. You've probably through the years have come to know more people who had trouble with credit card debt or identity theft and this, that, you know, so those years also mean a kind of wisdom that someone who's young and overeager to adopt a new technology, they might not have their guard up about some of these things. And, you know, you especially see this with people who are either, you know, of the Great Depression generation or offspring of people who really had it hard during the Depression. You know, they really believe that the safest thing they can do with their money is hide it in a box under their bed.
And that kind of brings up an interesting point, the difference between ingrained systems and the weight of history versus, well, you talk a lot about India and how they are just embracing this new cashless society idea because they don't have that kind of impediment and baggage to bring along. They don't have that embedded systems in place that would kind of prevent switching over.
Right. And this, for me, this was really the most revelatory part of the whole project, the exploring this very counterintuitive idea that cash is the enemy of the poor. And,
yes.
You know, going to India and seeing a young man in the slums of Delhi go, you know, just tell me what his life was like before this mobile money tool and after it. And before, it meant that when he wanted to send or deliver a tiny, tiny remittance payment to his family members in the countryside, it was like a day and a half bus ride to get there, a day and a half bus ride to get back. So that's 3 days away from income generation, right? He's got to pay someone to look after his little shop. He's got to worry about the rest of his modest savings hidden in a tea canister in his apartment. He's got to pay the bus fare, et cetera, all these costs, right? Just to deliver a little bit of money. And then he comes back. Now that he has one of these mobile banking and mobile money transfer tools through his phone, you know, not a smartphone. That's the thing I get all the time. Well, the poor don't have smartphones. You know, he's got this cheapo Nokia brand thing, just like the rest of the 3 billion people on Earth who also are using these things. He can send that money like a text message, you know, to his countryside. And it's just a staggering improvement in his well-being and in his potential for building financial stability, climbing out of poverty, and staying out of poverty. Because, you know, cash is actually a trap. Or if you're trapped in cash, you know, the costs are exacerbated. And, you know, it's not specifically because cash itself is bad. You know, the more nuanced reality is that cash's inconvertibility into electronic form can be so crushing for those people who are on the margins. And that's, you know, that's most of the planet. And,
right.
You know, this was really the most, you know, revelatory A and B, really. It was such exciting stuff to be reporting on because it's so world changing and happening right now. But it also pulled the conversation from the kind of, interesting, but also a little bit tongue in cheek. You know, banknotes are covered in germs. Okay, well, that's changed the world. But when you talk about the fight against global poverty and the importance of helping people access the formal economy and, you know, the Gates Foundation giving $500 million to support development of these kind of technologies. I mean, now you're really in a substantive area. And for me, that was just, it's just a delight to be learning about that and talking to experts about it. And again, you know, there's a kind of counterintuitive thread that as a writer or a journalist, you know, I devour that kind of thing because on its surface, again, who's going to indict cash, right? What could be better than for the poor than a handful of money? But in fact, it's not so simple. And money has different forms, and those different forms come with different costs. And it turns out that the costs of cash fall most heavily on the poor.
Yeah, that was one of the most illuminating part of the book for me. And just like you, I'm fascinated by the idea and excited by it.
Well, I think a number I saw recently is, so one of the banner examples of these technologies is a thing called M-Pesa in Kenya, which I think is going on about 5 years now. M, by the way, for mobile, Pesa is Swahili for money. And it started as a very simple money transfer service. The advertising was very straightforward, which was part of their success. You know, send money home, you know, remittance check. And the remittance payments I was just describing, often from an urban center like Nairobi to family members in the countryside, right? Well, already they have, I don't know if it's like a quarter or half of all adults in Kenya are using this service, but even more walloping of a figure is that more money, more value is moving through the pipeline of the M-Pesa system than Western Union is transmitting around the globe.
That's amazing.
It really is incredible stuff. And, you know, I think more people need to be writing about it. I certainly want to be.
Yeah. So then that kind of brings up my next question, which is, what are some of the advantages, shall we say, of the informal economy that a cashless society would need to replicate? For instance, what do you think would happen to under-the-table transactions? I mean, you mentioned paying a housekeeper as one example, or tipping, or flea markets, farmers markets. How about things like classified ads, local private sale or trade, penny pincher type of papers, websites like Craigslist? What do you think would happen with those kinds of things, or barter systems, for instance?
Well, I just am not of the opinion that sunlight is bad, and maybe that's because I'm a journalist, but you know, I'm very sympathetic to the waiter or the housekeeper who does not want to declare income because they're already on the edge and just getting pummeled because the economy is terrible, and we live in a society that enables and empowers the 1% at the expense of the 99%. But to me, it's faulty logic to go from there to then say, therefore, I think it's okay for the housekeeper to dodge paying taxes, even though I want Google to pay its taxes. You know, I understand that giant corporations hiding their taxes, you know, by way of convoluted schemes and offshore accounts has a much greater impact on the economy. But, you know, I think our nonchalance about everyday people hiding their taxes or hiding income and not paying taxes, or in your turn of phrase, under the table transactions, you know, our nonchalance about that actually circles back to kind of encourage an entire culture of nonchalance about honesty with money. And maybe that's why we and our our policymakers aren't more aggressive when it comes to clamping down on tax evasion. You know, the number right now from the most recent audit for the tax gap, right? What we owe versus what we pay, or I'm sorry, what we pay versus what we owe. You know, this is on the order of $400 to $500 billion a year.
Wow.
Now, not all of that is cash enabled evasion, obviously. Plenty of that is electronic, but a lot of it is because of cash. And so, you know, we need to do something about that. And it's sort of, you know, I don't want to sound preachy, although it's probably too late here, but that's all of us, right? And so until we can buck up and say, you know, it's not okay for the housekeeper, just like it's not okay for Warren Buffett. But having said that, you know, I feel like let me just do the other example here because it's even easier with immigration. A lot of people say, well, if you get rid of cash, how are we going to pay undocumented workers? Because they don't want the scrutiny. They don't want their transactions to be traceable because they get to get deported, et cetera, right? So what you're saying in parentheses there is that our horrible immigration system is okay. I want to keep the status quo. Therefore, I want to protect, you know, and therefore we need cash around to pay the undocumented workers working in the status quo situation. Do you see what I mean? Not only is cash kind of a drag and problematic, but we also have a totally unsustainable and terrible immigration system. Let's fix that. And the same thing could be said with tipping, right? So obviously I don't want to get rid of cash before we have suitable alternatives for covering the needs of waiters and bellmen and taxi drivers, et cetera. But I also think it's a false premise to say that, you know, to say confidently that our system of paying people like $2.20 an hour and then the rest of their income is covered by tips, you know, to say that that's like a really strong approach to compensation, I think is just so asinine. It's why Europe has completely moved to, you know, a service charge. And, you know, this is like 19th century aristocratic silliness, the culture.
Yeah.
And maybe what we need is not only to get rid of cash, but then also, in fact, pay people like a living wage. So, you know, it's almost like a two wrongs don't make a right situation for
right.
me when it comes to tax evasion or the tipping or the undocumented workers thing.
Well, I'm in total agreement with you there, because I've spent some time as a waiter, and it has always struck me as being very unfair.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like indentured servitude with like some frosting on top. It's just it's ridiculous.
And then to turn that around, you know, most waiters I ever knew have fudged a bit on reporting their tips.
Right. And, you know, I can't blame them again, but that's sort of a statement about the economy. I don't think that's
right.
A statement. I don't really think that's a defense of tax evasion, or I hope it is. You know what I mean? I just don't think tax evasion is okay. And I know there's a kind of anti-Robin Hood feeling to that kind of comment, also known as unpopular statement number 24 by David Bowman. But it's still the case. And I just, you know, corporate tax evasion and white collar crime and Wall Street bankers infuriate me as much as the next guy. But I think in a very indirect way, we enable them when we turn the other cheek to small scale tax evasion.
Oh, that's a very valid point. I have to say, I'm popular or not, I have to agree. Moving from that into a more technological realm, especially in the light of recent events like the hacking of multiple banking and merchant systems and credit card information, how much work do you think needs to be done to guarantee security and privacy enough that people would trust it, as it were, the switch to a cashless system or to a predominantly cashless system?
Much more work needs to be done. You know, it's interesting. There have been so many breaches with credit card companies, right? But, and yet, you know, it's not like they're going broke anytime soon. Yeah. Millions and millions and millions of people see a value proposition there. They see it as safe enough, and so they go for it. And I'm not saying you should or shouldn't, but it's an interesting thing that, you know, no system is totally safe, right? Same thing with cash.
No.
You could have a counterfeit in your wallet right now and just not know it. And so the issue is making it safe enough so that people do this kind of cost benefit or risk analysis where they say, okay, it's worth it to me. And, you know, the credit card companies to a great extent have achieved that. But I think, for technology companies, especially working in the mobile money space, you know, the bar is even higher because people are very suspicious of what's happening with their phone. And rightly so, I think, because as I read in the book, you know, it's one thing to drop a call. It's another thing if you're going to drop my money into the
I never
come back to you as a customer. Never, never, never. And I think a lot of these technologists and startups, they understand that need for robust security systems and redundancies to protect people's money and level of privacy, at least to the level that they're familiar with now, if not greater. So there's definitely room and need to make these systems stronger, but we also need to be a little bit more realistic about, you know, what is absolute security versus what is really, really strong security. The other thing is, I think it's, and I don't know if this is something you were envisioning or not, but I don't see us going from a cash society to a cashless society that use some alternative called X. You know, we're going to be a cashless society using alternatives, X, Y, Z, A, B, C, D, E, and F, like, and onward. You know, there's going to be this kind of great flowering of types of money and currencies and payment technologies that you can use through various digital devices. And in that sense, you know, cash is not something that's going to end because government declares it so on June 1st of 2025. You know, cash is dying this death by a thousand cuts, and slowly but surely, you know, there will come a day when banknotes and coins will be as anachronistic as a payphone, really, in my view. And, you know, 4 years from now, of course not. But I think that's the way to think about this. It's that it's being nudged aside by smarter and more convenient and more cost-effective tools that people are saying yes to. And I don't know if it will be the 700th new tool or the 50th new tool or the 10,000th new tool, but at some point we'll just have so many different ones that, you know, even governments and central banks will say, you know what, this is making and babysitting and transporting this stuff is just costing us a little too much money because nobody's really using it. Let's stop making everything but fives and dollar coins.
Well, and that's certainly a point that's well illustrated in your book, and it's one that I initially was a bit skeptical about, but you build a strong case, and it's a very entertaining case too. What do you see as the biggest hurdle or hurdles to maybe not giving up cash totally, but adopting this new monetary model? Is it social or psychological and emotional or technological or political or nationalistic? What do you think is the biggest factor or factors involved?
I think there are so many, political and nationalistic. Absolutely. I mean, look, here we can't even get rid of the penny. We can't even have an honest conversation about getting rid of the penny. So that's, you know, that's a sort of a messy stew of political and nostalgic and nationalistic sentiments, let alone sort of the psychology of money and the greenback. It's a very powerful totem of our identity as Americans, and I think a lot of people stand by it more than they might want to admit, you know, because who wants to admit that they kind of love money, right? Or at least the physical form of it, and without, because they don't want to sound like a greedy jerk, but, you know, we like these symbols and this imagery more than we sometimes admit. But so there's the psychology thing for sure. I think there are technological hurdles. Absolutely. Not just, we need new technologies to make sure that waiters and bellmen and taxi drivers aren't getting stiffed in the digital future, of course. But I think the other technological hurdles and probably one of the strongest defenses for having at least some cash around is, you know, the power outage that isn't just 7 hours, but what if it was 7 weeks, you know, and all of our devices have run out of battery power, and solar technology is hardly at a level where it could power everything, you know, so we would need, we need something to transact with. Right. And so I think that's a valid defense. I think maybe in the future we could actually end around that problem too, in that, you know, if we really, really were pretty much beyond cash, except for the disaster scenario, maybe we would have something like fives and tens issued by a combination of FEMA, the Red Cross, and the central bank that are distributed to citizens and stored in envelopes, and only you're only supposed to break them out after 1 week without electricity or something. And, you know, I'm sure this is a cockamamie idea that people could just shoot all kinds of holes in. But, you know, in other words, if we reach a point where really the only strong defense for having cash around is this like serious disaster scenario, well, then maybe we should put a little energy into coming up with a solution for it. Because if not, we're just going to be losing so much money and creating so much inefficiency in the economy during those many, many, many years without said calamity ever happening.
Right, right. And as one of the people in your book said, somebody will come up with something if it comes down to it.
I think so. And
but better to have a plan in mind ahead of time.
Exactly. And, you know, another way to look at that, as technologist Dave Birch says in the book, is that, you know, if this disaster scenario gets bad enough, at a certain point, you're actually not worrying. You're not going to be worrying about small value banknotes for everyday transactions. What you need to be stockpiling are cans of beans and blankets and bullets. So there's something to be said for that.
Right. What do you think would be the ideal form or concept of money, given no technological limits or emotional or political baggage?
Well, certainly electronic money, national currencies have to a great extent proven to be quite strong and successful. But I think There's nothing stopping us in the digital future from further innovation in the space of alternative and private and community currencies. So I'm quite excited about that. But I think, you know, how will we be transacting with these various forms of digital currencies, national or otherwise? I think it will be, you know, it will invariably be through the phone, or more likely the future device that people long ago referred to as the mobile phone.
Well, with that forward-looking thought, I think I've taken up enough of your time. Thank you so much for joining me and for your intriguing and very entertaining book, which I encourage all of our listeners to read. One final question. What are you working on now?
Well, I just published a story in Wired about a counterfeiter in Germany, a man who was quite a successful artist and printmaker, but he ran into financial troubles and started to counterfeit U.S. $100 bills to the tune of $16 to $20 million worth. And his story is quite interesting, and it just came out, and so I'm sort of dealing with some of the response to that and talking about if there might be a film potential there. And I have some other book ideas that are cooking at the moment, but I'm still, I'm still really busy talking about the end of money. And, you know, that's a delight. You know, as pat as it sounds, I'm really not tired of talking about this subject yet, because there are just so many facets and people bring really interesting new perspectives to the conversation all the time that, you know, sometimes in journalism, if you're writing about a certain species of beetle, at a certain point, you're just kind of done with it and you're ready for the next thing. And, you know, this topic is expansive enough that I haven't reached that that threshold yet where I'm tired of it. And so that's really nice, particularly because I don't have a new book topic yet.
Well, it is a far deeper discussion than might meet the eye at first, as you said. But again, thank you for joining me and for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it.
It's my pleasure, Greg. Thank you.
You've been listening to an interview with David Wolman, author of The End of Money, Counterfeiters, Preachers, Techies, Dreamers, and the Coming Cashless Society, which is published by DaCapo Press and is available now. It's well worth the read. I'm Greg Evans. I hope you enjoyed this New Books in Digital Culture podcast. If so, keep an eye out for the next one coming soon.